Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Today, we are finishing our interview with Chris Cotrone of the Platypus Affiliated Society. This is the last part of three.
Let's see. Oh, this has hardly been adversarial.
No, I know. I feel like we should be meaner.
Let me throw some salt. All right. So during the Trump campaign, this guy online who bears a resemblance to you and has the same name but doesn't seem to sound anything like you right now. I think around the time that Trump said, you know, grab him by the pussy, or there's some kind of, you know, tape of him saying this, he took this opportunity to defend a sexual assertiveness as not being equal to sexual aggression. And there's nothing about that statement I find in the abstract to be, you know, objectionable, but in the context seemed a bit, perhaps you bent the stick a bit too far that day, but I'm not sure exactly where you were coming from with it. So I just wanted to bring it to you.
All right. So, you know, I noticed the last few years, it's really starting under the last years of the Obama administration, that you had the recrudescence of PC identity politics, which I know all those terms are right-wing terms, whatever. I guess as a good leftist, you're not supposed to call it PC, you're not supposed to call it identity politics. But, you know, sometimes the right is able to call a spade a spade. And part of that was an anti-sex turn on the left. And you saw it in the sex scandals that wrecked a bunch of organizations, for example. And, you know, that were not really the reason for these organizations to be in crisis. The real reason for these organizations to be in crisis is that they lost their purpose in the Obama years. And so younger activists became disenchanted and woke up and discovered that, oh, there's, you know, sexual harassment or sexual abuse going on in these organizations. But that was just the occasion. It wasn't really the cause for the crisis of these organizations. So I noticed that that was starting to happen. And, you know, there was an article written by, I don't know if it's the Resuscitated Mem Notes Maoists, about like when like girls feel depressed after having sex with their boyfriends, the reason for that is that heteronormative patriarchal sexuality is oppressive of women, and, you know, sex is bad, penetrative heterosexual sex is bad, right? And so I thought, okay, this is happening, and that's before Trump.
So do you take this to be a widespread position?
No, I don't think that an anti-sex perspective is the way forward for socialists.
Well, not like progressive. I think we both agree that, as stated, that's not progressive. But I find a lot of people might agree with those premises, but not the conclusion.
Well, I mean, look, obviously, you know, clearly we live in a society in which all sorts of human potentiality is distorted and perverted and, you know, takes ugly forms, and, you know, there's real abuse in the world. And, you know, I don't know anything about Donald Trump in particular, but it seemed like, you know, trying to paint him as the rapist in chief based on the Access Hollywood tape revelation seemed like a stretch. And, you know, I watched Fox News go around and interview women about their reaction to the comments. And, you know,
would you disagree with the characterization of walk up to them and grab them by the pussy as sexual assault?
Is it sexual assault? I suppose that it is, like, strictly speaking, sexual assault, isn't it? Meaning that if anyone wanted to press charges against him, they could have. So, of course, it is sexual assault.
Well, not from a legalistic standpoint, but, you know.
I think from a legal standpoint, yeah, they could have called the cops on Trump and...
No, but I'm asking you, you know, like what he described, right? Like,
well, I think
in
that
your
any
point
of the women,
view.
Any of the women who were subject to that behavior by Trump would have been, if they so wanted to, justified in calling the cops on them. Absolutely. Right. In other words, it's up to them how violated they felt, you know, in other words, and whether they wanted to press charges. But, you know, right? And so the question is, as a cultural signifier, right? That's what we're really talking about. We're not talking about, like, actual human beings in a legal situation of crime. We're talking about what it signifies culturally, right?
I mean, I suppose that's maybe what the conversation is about. I'm not so invested in that conversation. I'm curious, and I know that you make these Facebook, you know, slogans, you know, like.
I have a lot of leftist followers on Facebook. You know, I got into trouble with a lot of my liberal friends around the election, and I had to tell them, look, I'm not posting this to provoke you. I'm posting it to provoke these leftists.
Of course, but, like, you know, there's an implication here that I'm trying to draw out beyond the spectacle and beyond the simulation.
Well, what does
Chris think about this, what Trump is describing there? Like, and maybe that's not the most interesting thing to you, but this is a hostile question.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I think probably I was sort of unmoved by it. In other words, I was probably more impressed by the reaction to it than I was by the thing itself. Meaning, you know, in other words, I was not particularly outraged by the behavior that Trump described, but I was shocked by the attempt to depict Trump as a rapist as a result of those.
Should not an Enlightenment view of humanist bodily autonomy or something suggest that there's something, you know, scandalous?
Well, you know, our bodies don't belong to ourselves, right? Like, in other words, we live in communities.
Women understand that, yes, of course.
If there's a breakout of an epidemic disease in which a lot of people are dying, then the community will constrain people and might even put them to death to save more people. Right? Our bodies don't belong to us.
Wouldn't you say there's a long-term tendency in enforcing this, maybe bimodally?
I mean, look, I obviously am in favor of sexual autonomy and self-determination of individuals. Like, absolutely, right? In other words, you know, there's no question about whether it's right to force people to have sex, right? There's no question of, like, rape or sexual assault or sexual harassment. Obviously, everyone, you know, has to have their rights respected. Absolutely. Like, no doubt about that. But, of course, that's always negotiated between individuals, right? And so we are talking about cultural norms. We're not talking about absolute autonomy. We're talking about cultural norms and when people feel violated. And I think that you have to take seriously when people feel violated. You know, in other words, if people feel violated, then it's a violation.
Okay. If that's the case, then as a revolutionary pedagogue, why sloganeer towards something like a...
I don't remember how I put it, but I'm sure I was careful about it. In other words, I'm sure I was both provocative and careful.
What if you weren't careful this time?
Well, then I guess I had a lapse. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what I was going to say is I was on a panel for Platypus with Catherine Liu, and it was on Marxism in the Age of Trump, and it was here in Chicago, down at the University of Chicago. And, you know, I didn't say anything about grabbing by the pussy, but she said, you know, okay, grab him by the pussy. Okay, I understand, you know, this is a straight man, you know, who was sexually interested in women. And yeah, that's reality. And I thought, oh, okay. I actually thought she went a little too far with that one. But, you know, if that was from a leftist perspective, you know, she thinks of herself as at least a progressive liberal. She actually thinks of herself as a socialist and influenced by the Frankfurt School, et cetera, et cetera. You know, yeah, that's that, you know, in other words,
it's possible for women to have a retrograde point.
Absolutely.
Of view on these things.
No, no doubt. But basically what she was saying was, you know, don't expect Trump to lose votes over that from women. You know, again, as a political phenomenon, that's what we got to deal with. Meaning, I don't think that socialists should be in a position to tell women what their moral values should be. Right. In other words, socialists shouldn't be organizing people according to culture. I mean, this is actually much more, I could get into much more controversial terrain than that. In other words, you know, I think that a lot of what's gone on in neoliberalism has undone the left because it's become culturalists, meaning that I I think that a socialist party could stand for reproductive rights without having to make the case for abortion, right? You can just say abortion should be decriminalized and legal and available. You could say that without having to engage in the kind of ideological feminist stuff about like how abortion is like good or something, right? In other words, you could kind of leave its cultural value alone. You could just be strictly about individual rights and the law and the state. You know, the state should have no place in regulating what people do with their bodies. You know, you could just take that perspective without having to get into the cultural signifiers of it. Complete. In other words, you should be able to have anti-abortion people at a cultural level participating in the socialist movement, period. In other words, people who believe that abortion is wrong, all you need to get them to believe is that it should be safe, free, legal, and available. You don't have to convince them that it's somehow morally neutral or okay. And if you think that you do, then you're never going to get anywhere.
We can agree with a lot of that on paper, but the reality is that a lot of anti-abortion politics is motivated by the desire to restrict women's autonomy. And so you do
actually
have to make a positive argument.
The Democratic Party has turned it into a cultural signifier.
That may be true. That may be true. But socialists do have to positively argue for women's emancipation.
Women's emancipation.
Bodily autonomy as part of women's emancipation. And
absolutely.
The unfortunate primate heritage of, you know, women basically across cultures being the ones that, either they have life or death say over, you know, fetuses and even early infancy, right? Even infants, early infancy, or men do. And the sort of historical materialist approach.
Traditionally, usually women.
But
up until the modern era, mostly these things were handled by women.
Right. And so, yeah, I think you do sort of have to make a positive assertion, even apart from the problematic and bourgeois expression of this.
Positive assertion also has to be that, you know, people have a right to biological reproduction. In other words, women have to be completely subordinated in their decision to have children. In other words, it can't just be this negative thing, like right to abortion, right to contraception. It also has to be the right to have children, whether they're married or not, or whatever, right? Like full support for biological reproduction has to be championed as well.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think that the kind of second wave feminist, like kind of pro-contraception, pro-abortion kind of perspective is a dead end. And it's also part of capitalist austerity. Meaning that, you know, we now live in a society in which it seems like you have to be rich to have children.
Well, it's part of the negative freedom that is sort of required for positive freedom. That's not to discredit it, but I do think, organically in feminism, you see like, you know, some proletarian and, you know, black and indigenous feminism and even, you know, trans women that want to have like implanted wombs and that sort of thing. Like, there's a broader tendency towards, you know, the freedom to reproduce as well. But I don't think that with these considerations, the dominant condition of women in the world is still one of unwilling subordination to this role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, generally speaking, there's a default traditionalism. Absolutely. Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, it's everything. It's like, most people don't understand why women are paid less money in the workforce. They think that it's like sexism, you know, that it's like, you know, disparagement towards women. No, it's actually statistical, meaning that it's understood that women are more likely to live with their parents than men are, and so you can afford to pay them less.
Well, also because the assumption of the potential for pregnancy can...
It's all sorts basically of things. The capitalists are ruthless about it, meaning they just look at the statistics and they just, you know, follow their interests. It's not because, you know, it's not because individuals have sexist attitudes about women. It's about, like, this is the reality, and if we can afford to pay women less than men, we're going to do that. In other words... It's got a ruthless logic to it, that is not just a direct expression of people's prejudices.
Well, yeah, sure. But that also takes it form in the capacity for pregnancy being a sort of flag on all women, even those that aren't capable of being pregnant. It kind of flags them with the sort of instability. There's an Endnotes article where they're
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. They talk about the sort of M-shaped employment curve for women and the dip during, you know, the prime of reproduction.
Reproductive age. I think that unfortunately, you know, the left has been forced into a position of having to dig itself out of a hole of a kind of new left and second wave feminist kind of culture war posture that it's had to sort of rediscover the rationality of certain older positions in the socialist movement and in Marxism. And, you know, I just wish that we didn't have to work through the cultural signifier realm. In other words, I wish that we could kind of set certain things aside. You know, it's like, I always felt this way about like homosexuality, you know, because I'm gay. I always felt like I just want to be left alone. I don't feel the need to have people decide that being gay is good or something. Like, you know, I'm not looking for like positive valuation of homosexuality. I just want to be free to live my life. You know, I don't want to have to convince people that it's like good, because why, you know? Right. Or another example of this in terms of personal autonomy is like drugs. You know, like I don't like drugs. I don't think drugs are good, but I think they should be completely legal. Right. So in other words, it's kind of like you don't have to be like down with the consumption of something to say people have a right to do what they want. You know, you don't have to convince people. Yeah. It's like Kamala Harris saying that, you know, she's from the joy seeking culture of Jamaica, and that's why she's pro marijuana. And it's like, is that the argument? Right. Is the argument that, like, you know, pot is good? Is that the argument? Or is the argument that the state shouldn't penalize people for narcotics? You know, like, and again, like, if the socialist movement has to, like, adopt a whole set of cultural values, it's never going to get anywhere.
So I guess my hostile question is actually in a very, very different vein, although it might be related to a certain platypus or platypus adjacent trolls that you sometimes encounter on the internet. Do you think that, and on this I have my own opinions because I was actually in the group, but do you think that you're, that what you are attempting to do with your syllabus is actually understood by the left? Which I think the answer to that is clearly no, but I'll let you adjudicate that. And also completely understood by your own students and interlocutors internally.
So what do you have in mind when you ask?
Well, I can think about like some of the crazier trollness I've seen. For example, I actually don't know if this person is a Platypus member, but they were definitely a fellow traveler. It was talking about how the U.S. West was won as opposed to taken. Now, I kind of get what they're going against, but that is such a vulgar way to get people to engage with you that almost...
You mean manifest destiny. You
yeah.
mean like the Western North American continent.
Yeah, which that doesn't seem like a leftist position to me. And
right. You mean like contrarianism and kind of counter-identification, like inverting the values on the left or something.
I mean,
you know, maybe, you know... Right. It can look that way. I mean, it's kind of like internally in Platypus, we've talked about the different phases of our history. And so, like, were we anti-imperialists, right? And in the more recent period, have we been anti-Trumpists or something? And it's kind of like, well, no, because that would be kind of silly to just take the opposite position of the left, right? Just to be, you know, provocative and contrarian. I think that at one point, a few years ago, before I really understood this language, I didn't really know, like someone called me a shitposting edgelord. And I was like, is that what I am?
Uh-huh.
You know, in other words, I was like just saying things like shitposting and trying to be edgy, like an edgelord is, you know, but I was a little shocked that like, you know, like, sure, I try to be provocative, but the idea of the shitposting edgelord, like, I thought, well, I actually do have better things to do with my life than just shitpost or be an edgelord, right? So, like, that isn't what I'm about. But there is this culture, right, especially online culture. And so, I don't know, does Platypus attract shitposting edgelords? Maybe. I mean, I would say that generally speaking, our members are not that, because that kind of behavior is looked down upon, you know, and so I don't know.
Knowing some of your members, I would actually agree with you. It's just the people that people are most likely to engage with. I mean, so for example, I know that the campaign for Socialist Party in the USA is a completely independent project from Platypus, but I don't know that many people would even know that the two things had any relationship at all.
That's intentional, actually. I was going to start the campaign for a Socialist Party under a pseudonym to make it, you know, and to actively exclude anyone in or around Platypus from participating in it. That was my original intention. But then I thought, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But I thought that's kind of silly. Like, that's not really necessary. And I also thought it might be like, you know, to have myself be out there in the activist realm might alleviate some misapprehensions about Platypus. In other words, having me act like an ordinary leftist might help dispel some of the myths about Platypus. In other words, it might help define what Platypus is by having something else that it's not.
Well, I should say it's probably not going to be that hard to not have people join you into that, considering it. It almost seems like it's the polar opposite of Platypus's point of view, even within this ambiguation that you've laid out there versus ideologues versus activists. I think in practice, there's a reason that people believe certain things. Mm-hmm. Like,
I think my other criticism that was implied in that question, though, is that when I first got interested in Platypus, I didn't read the Platypus Review. I read your mission statement, and coming out of the anti-globalist left in the late '90s, which kind of drove me crazy, and I went pretty far right for a while. It really appealed to me. But when I read the Platypus Review at first, and when I see people would be sharing it, particularly during the Occupy period, was kind of a high point. They didn't understand what you guys were trying to do. They being the general left. And so, like, you know, you release an interview with Zizek or Dominic Lacerto or somebody like that, and people wouldn't realize that it was critical. And then they would feel betrayed when they realized what the focus of Platypus really was, even though it was clearly stated on the mission statement. So,
well, again, we're not polemical. In other words, there's a difference between being critical and being oppositional or polemical. And I think that that's easily lost. In other words, we do live in a kind of black and white thinking, kind of either or mentality environment. And in that respect, I think that usually people think that being critical means simply opposing. You know, so that's one tricky part. The other tricky part, so this is the spirit in which we do things, right? So in other words, critical doesn't mean just tearing down, right? The issue is, what can be learned from the existing left? And there's a kind of a positive negativity, meaning like the Spartacists would polemicize in order to clarify, right? They had that kind of approach. And, you know, I've always been aware that that can get you somewhere, but it can't get you very far. And it also can't get you very far under present day conditions, meaning that might have been more meaningful in the 60s and 70s, but it's increasingly less meaningful and really inappropriate now. In other words, that the criticism is also not meant to be positive in the sense of us being smarter than the left or knowing better or something, right? The critical approach is really about the limits. Like finding the limits and recognizing that we share in those limits, meaning, you know, it's not supposed to be a kind of a subtle send up or a, you know, subtle tear down of someone to interview them, for example. But it's rather, you know, if you know, we engage the interesting symptomatic phenomena of the death of the left, and we're interested in the left being as good as it possibly can be in order to chart out the limits of perspectives which doesn't mean that, you know, we have perspectives that transcend those limits. We really don't. Like, Platypus doesn't really have, like, a better, like, what we have is history. In other words, we do have a sense that the left used to be more politically capable than it is today. And so it's not just like, oh, well, Lenin was smarter than people are today. I mean, he was, but that doesn't mean that we can just hold up Lenin as a positive example. So I guess the other, you know, so we weren't anti-imperialists and we're not anti-Trumpists. And we also weren't anti-Leninists in the Occupy moment, right? In other words, the anarchists sort of anti-Leninism, we weren't like the anti-Leninists either. Right. But rather, do we accept the challenge of history, meaning that historical Marxism is a kind of a high watermark to aspire to? That doesn't mean that it can just be upheld as a positive example. Right. So the Spartacists try to do that. Like, they try to just say, you know, they try to have a kind of orthodox critique and polemic against the existing left. That works to a certain degree, but it doesn't really work beyond a certain point. We need to get back to something like old style Marxism, something like Lenin, but that doesn't mean a simple recapitulation. And frankly, of course, we have to do better, right? That's the other point, is that, you know, as good as the old style Marxism was, it failed. So, you know, we have to do at least as well as they did, which probably means doing something like what they did, but also different from what they did. And not only that, but we have to do better than they did.
Yeah.
But how do you start to grasp that? That's the difficulty. How do you start to imagine that, like, in terms of possibilities?
So in the last 5 years
or so, even in the reading group, mm-hmm. I'll just say one thing, Derek, about the reading group. Mm-hmm. So yeah, do people understand the reading group? Well, maybe not. But the point is that, like, they're at least exposed to things mm-hmm. that could get them thinking. Right? So that when they encounter, like, the ISO or the PSL or whomever, or EndNotes or Viewpoint magazine, when they read references to Lenin or Trotsky or Luxembourg or whatever, they at least know what's being talked about, right? And have a sense that, oh, maybe there was more to Lenin's critique of imperialism than the usual anti-imperialist Leninist left. You know, in other words, that there would be a sense that actually, oh, they seem to be saying the same thing as Lenin, but actually they're saying something different. And Lenin was, there was kind of something more there in Lenin that seems missing now in the people who intone him, right? It's, you know, that's at least, you know, the modest goal that we've had.
Okay. I'm going to ask something that isn't antagonistic nor positivistic, just sort of how things have changed, because right after I left in 2013, one of your former members, Ben Campbell, and in some degree, it seems like the ISO decontextually leaked a whole lot of the internal email server.
Oh, yeah, the boycott letter.
Yeah, and wrote the boycott letter and all that. And the response on the left that I was exposed to, now, admittedly, at the time, I was either in, I was in South Korea at the time, but it was still going on when I was in Mexico. So I didn't see it on the ground. It seems like for about 2 years, there was sort of open ostracism in regards to to what you guys were doing. That seems to have eased up a little bit, although
it's shifted.
Yeah, it's shifted. Now people are mad about the Trump articles. How has that changed or complicated what Platypus is trying to do? Like, I mean, there's always been certain groups, like, to some degree, like the ISO would never really engage with you, but like...
No, they engaged us early on. They were on a bunch of panels that we put on.
Oh, they did?
And they used to actually... And they were on our very first panel. They were on a bunch of panels. They were on panels on socialism and anarchism, you know, Marxism and anarchism. They were... they were on a panel about Iraq at the Left Forum. They were on a bunch of things. And they used to send their young contacts to our reading group, not to infiltrate or challenge us or anything, but they used to just tell them, oh, if you want to get some basics on Marxism, just go to the Platypus reading group. So it was very different.
Actually. That's a very, very different thing even when I was around. Yeah.
Yeah, that was all before 2011, right? And I think that what happened was there was more optimism when Platypus started out. Generally on the left, there was this moment. And as that moment passed, then the left groups just retreated into their traditional sectarianism. And so we just fell victim to that. In other words, they became less interested in sort of open conversations about things and just hunkered down in their usual unilateral kind of activity. Mm. And it seemed less beneficial to them to engage in those kinds of debates because, you know, they were on the defensive. They were on the retreat. They were recruiting less people. They saw us more as competition. So when there was, you know, more activity going on, more optimism, it's because they didn't see us as competition. And so as the left dried up, then, of course, we appeared to be more competitive. That's in terms of the established organizations. In terms of, like, the millennial left, well, of course, the millennial left went through phases of anti-imperialism and anti-fascism. You know, we're aware of the fact that the left is internally divided along various lines, and we don't fit into any of those divisions. And those divisions aren't always so pronounced. In other words, in periods of decline or retreat, in periods of pessimism, the existing differences on the left become accentuated. And of course, Platypus trying to include the entire left in our activities. Of course, we suffer from that because our desire to invite certain perspectives onto our panels then offends other people, right?
Right.
So when the left gets more internally fractious, then of course Platypus suffers. Because it's like, well, what are you doing inviting those people, right? It's like, well, the whole point is that we're trying to host the conversation of different perspectives on the left, right? And so they start seeing that as like more ill-intentioned.
So you get tarred as being spiked or anti-Dutch or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, the anti-Deutsch, like that whole thing, you know, we published that crazy article, Communism in Israel, because we had a lot of German members who were influenced by the anti-Deutsch. And so, you know, we thought that translating it into English and publishing it in the English-speaking world would sort of expose the anti-Deutsch in a particular way, would allow our own German members to hear it in a different way, to see the kind of craziness of it in a different way. But of course, you know, people thought, oh, well, this is like an endorsement of the anti-Deutsch. Even though we immediately published a criticism of the anti-Deutsch that attacked Platypus for being too Leninist and treating the anti-Deutsch as a kind of inverted Leninism, which you could say it is. In other words, anti-Deutsch comes out of Maoism, and it is a kind of inverted German nationalism. It's a weird kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Leninism meaning Stalinism. And, you know, but again, it's kind of like, well, yeah, if you read the mission statements, then, you know, if you read, you know, our explicit programmatic, if you will, documents for our project, it should be clear what we're doing. But, you know, again, we started on the premise that the left would find what we were doing advantageous to them and useful. It would increase their exposure among students, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, that it wouldn't come down to nefarious motives or disagreements, right? Anyway, yeah, that's the short story, is that because the left has hunkered down into its usual sectarianism, Platypus's activities have been less welcome.
Lexi, can you think of any other good hostile questions?
Yeah, let's see. As part of your kind of consideration of the what you've called the libertarian liberalism mm-hmm. of the 19th century, you have articulated an interest in Herbert Spencer and in the tradition of social Darwinism. Now, as an historical materialist and even as someone who would be is interested in critical theory, or as someone who approaches Marxism from a sort of, you know, I don't know, more or less sort of a fan of science, I fucking love science type. Mm. How do we square the significance of social Darwinism in history with the need to synthesize evolutionary biology as we know it with a more historical point of view? Because I think, you know, invoking Spencer is provocative, and you know, we should be willing to learn from our enemies, liberals that are scientifically literate. But social Darwinism, though.
Well, that's a vexed question. I mean, obviously, you know, I don't think that Herbert Spencer's significance is primarily as a social Darwinist. The very issue of social Darwinism is interesting, meaning that, you know, is one talking about a Darwinian struggle among different social forms, or is one seeing society as the expression of evolutionary biology? Because I think those would have to be disaggregated. I don't think that Herbert Spencer thought that, like, superior civilizations were based on superior biology, right? But he did have a notion of superior civilizations. And so getting back to that, I was just interested at the time that I took it up. I was interested in it as late 19th century liberalism. In other words, what is the nature of Marxism's relationship to liberalism? And specifically, the militant versus industrial society. In other words, the liberal critique of socialism as regressive, as a retreat into a kind of ancient democracy, the democracy of the polis, kind of communitarianism. So, you know, in that way, Herbert Spencer has a classical liberal perspective, which is that he doesn't think that the future of human civilization and of society and freedom and the development of the human species lied in the direction of militancy, but rather industry, right? And I think that the left in particular is very confused about that. In other words, I think that the left does embrace socialism on the worst grounds as a kind of militant communalism. And in that way, liberalism remains better than socialism. The degree to which socialism thinks of itself as a militant communalism, as a kind of tribal collectivism, whether understood in class terms or whatever, I think that it's kind of helpless in the face of real bourgeois freedom. And my point there was that, you know, Marx is not a collectivist, right, in that way, right? He's not.
Yeah.
And so, again, the point of that article was just to say there's an interesting phenomenon of Herbert Spencer and Marx, their graves glaring each other in Highgate Cemetery, which is to say that Marxism tried to transcend the regressive character of socialism and tried to, in that sense, sublate liberalism and even a kind of late liberalism, even a kind of liberalism in extremis of a Herbert Spencer, you know, would be something that Marx took a lot more seriously than a kind of primitive socialism. In other words, that the future lies through industry, not militancy, which again, you know, people think that like the Black Panther Party was like the most serious political thing that ever took place in the United States in recent decades. And it's like, well, but you know, the problem with the Black Panther Party is that they never quite squared the circle of militancy.
Arguably, there's a sort of town and country thing here. Well, I'm a domesticated urban, you know, softy. Like, you know, there is a pretty pronounced difference between where I'm from in the Northeast and, you know, sort of even suburban or, you know, outright rural Arizona, where I'm sitting right now, where the specter of militancy does come back up in these zones that are more abandoned by capital. I don't know. There's even something to the way that a socialist or, you know, dictatorship of the proletariat would have to make so-called, you know, despotic inroads on capital. That does give it a dual character. That, and although I appreciate the desire to make, you know, socialism more, I don't know, rhizomatic, whatever you want to, however you want to like talk
more
about the way that it
association of the producers, the free association of the
right. Yeah, however you want to talk about how socialism enhances freedom. There are elements of so-called bourgeois liberty that are, that would be suppressed, but it wouldn't. You wouldn't want it to be the ones that actually have this content of enabling the choices of the proletariat.
I mean, ideally, they wouldn't be suppressed at all, but in reality, they will be suppressed. Largely as a function of civil war, however. And of course, civil war will involve militancy. And, you know, I joked during the Trump election with friends of mine, you know, and I said, you know, it's always the who whom question, right? Lenin, who's using whom? And I thought, you know, okay, well, let's say that Trump really is like trying to utilize the white nationalists and the KKK and the neo-Nazis. And, you know, and I thought, okay, well, the flip side of that is, you know, does the left think that it can like utilize like, you know, Afrocentric, you know, black nationalists Right. And I thought, well, you know, in the revolution, like, let's say that we make a revolution in the United States and there's like more or less a civil war condition, which is not guaranteed. But let's say that it is, that takes the form of a civil war. Well, you know, socialists might be able to make use of, you know, Afrocentric black nationalists and crazy, you know, cracker white nationalists, right? Like, you might have to take the KKK and drop them, you know, in the Middle East to fight ISIS, right? Like, in other words, you might have to, like, deal with people who are basically reactionary in one form or another. You know, if you guys ever heard of Isaac Babel, he's a Soviet author. He wrote in the Civil War, and he wrote about, like, the Cossacks, the Red Cossacks in the Civil War, right? So the Cossacks, like, there were Cossacks who joined, like, the dictatorship of the proletariat and fought as part of the Red Army in the Civil War. And these are people who could just as easily have been Black Hundreds, right? So they just so happened to decide that they, you know, they supported the Red Army out of Russian nationalism. And, you know, so, like I said, my joke at the time was, you know, it's not like, oh, see, you know, Trump is secretly a Nazi. It's like, well, the challenge of politics is how do you use people, you know? And all sorts of people are going to join the revolution for all sorts of reasons. And the only point is whether they can be used, right? As opposed to using the revolution to advance their reactionary agenda. In other words, if you can convince people that the revolution is the way to realize their reactionary agenda, as long as you're using them and they're not using you, right? Like, that's the bottom line is. And again, this is where we have to get away from our culturalism, right? It's not going to be about, like, ideological purity or, like, you know, matters of conscience or, you know, it's just not going to be about that. It's never going to be about that.
Well, we started this conversation with the conflict between sort of the politics that I think have been articulated here and the influence of the Frankfurt School. And I don't think I could put it better than that. Politics is about how to use people. And the short-term cycles of instrumental reason are the engine of a dialectic of enlightenment where, you know,
reason becomes,
yeah. No,
I'm not saying it's not treacherous, but I am saying, you know, like this kind of idea that, you know, I remember having an argument with a friend of mine in grad school, early on in grad school at the University of Chicago, and he literally thought that Marxists believed that, like, socialism will be achieved by most people being converted to Marxism ideologically. And I was like, not at all, you know?
People do, like, behave this way.
Yeah, and it's like, so you think that, like, the majority of people need to, like, read Marx and Engels and agree with them? And I'm like, not at all. You know what I mean? Like, it's just that's not how socialism is going to be accomplished. Socialism is not going to be accomplished by turning everyone into an ideological Marxist.
Right.
Never. Right. That will if we're waiting for that, it will never happen. And not only that, but the success of the revolution will make Marxism ideologically less necessary. In other words, fewer people will have to be Marxists after the revolution. So, you know, it's not about, like, you know, again, the militant society idea. It's not like we're going to establish the Marxist polis in which everyone's on the same page with dialectical materialism. No, no. Right. But so in terms of the role of militancy, militancy is going to be jagged, meaning people are going to be militant, but that doesn't mean ideologically consistent. Right. And hopefully the need for militancy will be minimal. Right. In other words, you know, I think a transition to socialism should involve as little civil war as possible. The real political trick is to render your enemies harmless so that you don't have to defeat them militarily.
It is actually funny to me that that would even be a controversial statement, but it somehow is.
I think that imagine it's going to be the culture war to the max. Like, it's going to be like the culture war raised to a murderous level or something.
I mean, if it is, then the war devours the revolution.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And, you know, they think it's going to be a repeat of, like, the peasants, like, lynching their landlords in China. You know, and it's like, well, fine, the peasants lynch the landlords. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not too sympathetic to the landlords. But, like, ideally, the transition to socialism in China would involve as little of that as possible. You know, because the point is, you can just, you know, render the landlord harmless. You know, you don't have to, like, kill the landlord because his grandfather raped your grandmother. But I think the left really believes that. I think that a lot of people on the left really believe that the revolution is like settling ancient scores of social justice. And, you know, thankfully, their perspective will never win. In other words, socialism will never be accomplished that way. And thankfully, these people who think that are just the tiny minority that's irrelevant.
Well, I do think there's sort of, again, to tie it back to the Frankfurt School and how this is sort of the odd thing out. Mm-hmm. Like Adorno following Benjamin, you know what I mean, has this idea of the resolution of all the injustices of history, sort of like
redemption.
Yeah, there it is. The redemption of the dead laborers and the redemption of the
sacrifice. History. No, yeah. Certainly. There I'm
this is less. This is something that, like, I don't know. I think in general, you know, when you're talking about how you saw the forms of collectivism and essential conservatism in socialism, something that Marx wanted to get beyond. There is something genuinely progressive about the naive progressive point of view versus this more, you know, bong rip world historical revanchism. Like, which I kind of feel both sides of this, and maybe one is disentangleable from the other, but playing up one can certainly exacerbate the problems that a revolution already poses.
Possibly. I always, you know, so contemporary of the Frankfurt School would be W.E.B. Du Bois. And I love this passage from the beginning of Black Reconstruction in America, where he describes the experience of transatlantic slavery and slavery in the Americas as the, like, sacrifice of people, you know, so that Black people could finally participate in the Reconstruction, like, radical democratic experiment. And, you know, in other words, the point is not like future sacrifice, right? The point is the world has sacrificed a lot and continues to sacrifice a lot. And only the achievement of socialism will make that sacrifice worthwhile. Like, you certainly can't say that all of the sacrifices involved in capitalism are in and of themselves at present worth it. They're not. Like, in other words, capitalism has been far more destructive than it has been emancipatory. And so you can't quite redeem all of that suffering. You can't. Like, there is an unredeemable character to it. But you can at least say, hopefully all of that sacrifice is not simply in vain, which is what it remains under capitalism. Right? It remains a just a waste. You know, meaning, you know, was it necessary to make it possible to lead the world to socialism through the dictatorship of the proletariat? Was the, you know, genocide of Native Americans necessary for that? No. Like, real crimes were committed that can never be redeemed at all. But the question is, will anything come out of this massive sacrifice of capitalism? Anything at all? Could it be redeemed in any even minimal degree at all?
Right.
Or is it just a massive destruction at the end of history?
Well, yeah. Fittingly, I find us on the same page at the end here. Yeah, real hostile.
Yeah.
You know, no one who's actually ever interacted with me ever has come away feeling like very pissed off and angry, except for maybe Andrew Kleiman. Maybe. But, you know, like, I
would imagine so.
Yeah, but that might be psychological. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. But generally speaking, you know, it's like, I mean, this is difficult stuff. And part of my strategy, you know, in terms of my public comportment, is to be a little bit provocative, but usually not gratuitously, right? Like, not just for the sake of it. Right. Like, so the shitposting edgelord thing, you know, it kind of doesn't work because, you know, I'm not like interested in just offending people or, you know, or being contrary. But, you know, there's difficult stuff and usually people avoid the difficult stuff. And so I do have a little bit of a penchant for calling attention to the difficult stuff, you know, because I think, you know, think again. Right. Like, my general ethos is, you think something, think again about this.
But I don't think that that's out of step with the good ones among the shitposting edgelords. I mean, I genuinely think that, you know, some people are contrarian, you know, with the cause. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's true. You know, then it's just a matter of how responsibly so. I mean, I kind of feel like, was Lenin a shitposting edgelord? I guess he was. But then I guess what the example would be today would be like, I don't know, spiked or something. I mean, I don't know. I don't find their provocations very interesting or provocative in that sense. I kind of usually feel like it's just a sort of, you know, because they have the whole RCP thing, the risk culture stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they have the whole nanny state risk culture stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I guess there's a point to that, but there's really not much of a point to that. You know, and so they do sometimes do some of that. And I kind of feel like, okay, so you want to say people should give themselves cancer if they want to. Okay. You know what I mean? Like,
they have some really fun points of view. Like, you know, environmentalism, that's just really, that's misanthropic. You know, you can't say that stuff.
They strain. Yeah. They strain it a bit. So, you know, and I always feel like, okay, there's not a point to being that provocative. And also I know what I don't know, and I know what I haven't really made up my mind about too. In other words, I know, like, I'm not going to die on that hill, you know, I'm not going to, like, you know, there are some things that I'm agnostic and kind of equivocal on, you know, so it's not like I have to have an opinion on everything and it has to be the edgiest, most contrarian opinion, or, you know, there are some things that I just don't care about and I'm not sure that I think much about, but there are some things that I do. And so those things that I do, I want to encourage people to think about more.
All right.
All right. Well, I've enjoyed this. This will probably come out. I have no idea when this will come out. Probably in about a month or two, I'll tell you. All right. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.